I think of them as being sort of like at the top of the pyramid, if you can picture that. And a developer is leveraging their knowledge and expertise in the space. Like the developer has like the vision of the entire project. And then they're going out and hiring all these different third-party companies to help them build the project. So like for us, like we are not vertically integrated at the moment. So we go out and we hire an architect, a civil engineer, the construction company, and we hire all these different companies to help us build the project instead of doing this all ourselves.
What's better than earning money from a 9-to-5 job? It's earning money while you sleep, which is made possible if you start investing. You're listening to the Real Estate Investing Demystified with your very own dynamic duo, Ava Benesaki and August Binias. Tune in as we discuss everything real estate, both on the passive and active sides. We feature life-changing stories of today's real estate leaders that will help build your own roadmap to success. This is a show that will lead you to a diversified portfolio, a much bigger revenue, and a next level venture that brings you a smooth cash flow. Let's get this episode started. Welcome back to Real Estate Investing Demystified.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have a great show for you today. We're actually super excited, Ava and I, because our guest is so experienced, so knowledgeable. I'm going to be continue edifying him on the preview of the show here, but we're excited to learn from our guests. So, and that's really the point of the show, to bring on expert guests for people to learn and have, you know, enjoy it as well, you know, get entertained as well. So
yeah, and absolutely. And we've actually been following Justin for many years now. How many years do you think?
I think it's been at least 5 years.
On LinkedIn. We've seen him, but we have never actually met him in person, like or face to face like we are now. So we have lots of questions and lots of fun topics to talk about. So,
but that's the thing about LinkedIn, right? Yeah. LinkedIn is a platform where, I mean, different demographics hang out on different type of social media platforms, right? LinkedIn is particularly for business owners. A lot of people, people in business, finance, and particularly people in real estate who are thought leaders, who are very, very well known. They spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. They quote LinkedIn a lot. They learn from LinkedIn. LinkedIn is the platform that they do. And that's the feeling we have. With Justin.
You feel like you know the person.
Exactly.
Yeah, like that's the whole purpose of it.
No, absolutely. Justin used to be a partner in a multifamily value add firm, so we saw a lot of information there. He's also a great analyst, and some of his financial models have been used from people that I've known, and I think he's added a lot of value to people using financial models. And for people who don't know that, like Excel, like a simple Excel form is used to calculate performance for projects, but on larger deals like multifamily acquisition deals or development deals, these financial models get super complex. Our VP of investments, Paul Hopkins, oversees that department. And one day I asked him, like, hey, you know, I want to get a little bit more familiar with financial modeling. Should I take some courses? How many hours do you think you've spent? He like almost smirked at me, saying he's spent thousands of hours on financial modeling. But with AI these days, it's getting a lot easier. So we're excited to have our show. Looking forward to this. Any points I missed here? We're going to give you guys a crash course on the world of development. These, you know, all these structures that are getting built, housing getting built for people. You know, housing is always great, right? It makes better places for people to live and more homes. And it keeps prices in check as well. The more development that takes place, the more supply that comes online, it keeps those prices both for rents and purchase prices in check, because supply is the biggest factor on prices.
Yeah, absolutely. And August used to be in development. You know, it's a very sophisticated world. You were obviously working on a project in Vancouver for many, many years. It's just about at its, you know, finish line. We know what it takes to develop a property. We're doing a build-to-rent deal right now in San Antonio, Texas. So we know what goes in behind it. So let's welcome our guest to the show, Justin Gooden. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So Justin, let's just start things off. Are you still involved in multifamily? What is the current market in multifamily? Let's start off there before we get into development.
I am, yeah. Actively building, not like existing multifamily projects, if that's what you meant, but mainly just 100% focused on ground up multifamily development here in Indiana.
So that wasn't an opportunistic play where you focused more on ground up development of multifamily. But your company's mandate is now solely on development, not acquisition of existing multifamily properties.
Correct. And that's how I got my start, like doing the value add business strategy, which is still, you know, a very lucrative and fulfilling strategy. But I just made the pivot to go into Class A, market rate, multifamily and mixed use development here in Indiana. A few reasons for that. I mean, I think like the biggest reason that comes to mind, and I'm sure you guys know this as well, is the value add space is extremely competitive. And that whole space and niche has really blown up in the last 5, 10, 15 years. And when that space blows up like that, it creates a lot of competition and causes a lot of the same companies to go after and chase the same kind of assets, which drives down cap rates, drives up prices, and just makes that space very difficult to find deals that actually pencil out. So one of the biggest reasons I just felt the space was very just inflated and very competitive. I spent like over an entire year trying to find just one deal that penciled out, and I just couldn't do that. The prices just didn't make sense of what sellers were wanting, what brokers were presenting prices for. So I just spent a lot of trial and error and a lot of time just not finding deals, and it just made it really difficult to continue buying and scale my business. Not that development isn't competitive on its own. I mean, it absolutely is. But in the space that I'm in and developing projects that are between 50, 100, 150 units, there's not a lot of developers, at least like here in Indiana, that are focusing on projects in that size. Mm-hmm. So I found a really competitive edge going into that sort of size project in Indiana. And I'm actually getting more deal flow, more volume, and doing more deals than I was on the value add side. Second biggest reason for making the pivot is, I mean, again, like as you guys know, after buying the property and doing the asset management on some of these C-class and B-class deals and managing the contractors, managing the renovations, all the risk you're taking with going after and chasing that pro forma, a lot of risk and a lot of just unknown factors that go into the value add space that I think a lot of people don't talk about. But yeah, just all that work and risk on the value add side just made like more sense for my goals and what I wanted to do long-term to pivot into ground-up multifamily development.
Yeah, I was going to say, he mentioned that deals weren't penciling out, just really quickly on the same topic. As interest rates decline and you know, things kind of, there hasn't been a whole lot of deals that are penciling out. We can agree with you there, absolutely. But as interest rates kind of trend downwards, where do you think the multifamily market, value-add market is going to be going? In that middle market space, right, 10 to 50 million, do you think there's going to be good multifamily value-add opportunities coming up here? Maybe, you know, we all thought that 2025 was going to present a lot of great opportunities. Oh, distress is hitting, trillions of dollars, commercial real estate loans are coming to maturity. This is so exciting. We're going to get our hands on things. Then we found out that banks were like, well, we're only really worth the value of the loans that we give out. So we want to make sure that these loans don't go belly up. And we want to try to, you know, work with the sellers to so that they keep the property to, you know, continue managing the property.
So
kick the can down the road. Exactly. Now it's 2026. Let's see what happens. We believe probably 2027 is actually where opportunities are going to present themselves. Where do you think multifamily value add opportunities are, you know, if there's any coming up here? Like, what are your thoughts on what's happening in the next year or two?
I think it's still going to be a lucrative strategy. I think the value add space is going to continue, you know, growing and thriving, of course. But I do think a lot of older properties are going to be less competitive than how they've been in the past, 5 or 10 years or so. And we're already kind of seeing that. We're already seeing a lot of well-known buyers and institutions stay away from properties that are built in the 60s, 70s, and some like even in the 80s. So I think we're going to see like a major pivot of buyers that are wanting the value-add space and opportunity, but not so much in the 60s and 70s asset. I think those assets are going to become very, very tough to sell in the coming years because there's going to be such like a major shift of buyers still wanting to stay active, but they're not wanting all the deferred maintenance, all of the delinquency, all of the risk that comes with buying these older properties. So I think people are going to still continue buying these, existing and value add deals, but I think we're all going to see like a major pivot into newer assets, 1985 and newer, 1990s and newer.
Well, yeah, that old strategy of buying 80s value add deals is, you know, relatively speaking, that's like 90s today, right? Because that's what people have been saying since post GFC, since 2011 and onwards. And just want to touch on the point you make, deals not penciling. Now, people who are not experienced in the space every day and don't sit on a call with an acquisition team that I do twice a week to see what type of deals coming to our pipeline and watching those deals coming in and either not trading at all or us running a LOI and, you know, making to the best in the final and the deal just, you know, being traded to somebody else, not being able to acquire it because the price that the deal is being presented at is 30% more than what we're willing to pay for it. But that all stems from what are the LP economics? What is the investor economics we're trying to achieve for our investors? Now, there are some levers we can pull. We can try to be aggressive and lower the GP economics to pump up the LP economics. We can be a bit more aggressive on our rent growth assumptions, on our exit cap. But at some point, you are basically either fooling yourself or treading on the line of being unscrupulous when it comes to numbers, and then you're factoring in other fees that are associated with the GP as well. But if you're not achieving, you know, between 15 and 20% average annualized returns for your LPs, which is realized through cash flow the property produces, the yield, and then the upside on the back end, the deal is not going to make sense, because most investors are going to go invest in different financial instruments that's going to be much less riskier. And we're going to touch on that in a moment as well. But the idea is that, and then the other factor is people don't realize that commercial real estate is not like single family. Single family, somebody passes away, there's death, divorce, other factors that people will sell no matter where the market is at. In commercial real estate, multifamily, other asset classes, they will hold on. If they have to refi, they will hold on. Now, there is some cases that they have to sell, but it's very far in between, and other groups come and gobble those up. So there's cases where deals just don't make sense and people can't buy deals. Yeah. You know, groups that bought 30 or 40 deals a year have done two deals in 2025. That tells you where we're at. Or another group that we know that did $5 billion of deals over the last 10 years, and in 2025, they didn't buy a single deal.
Unbelievable.
But let's keep going here.
Yeah, let's. So Justin, you know, we saw your post on LinkedIn, your $33 million development project that seems to be complete or almost complete. Was this your first development? And a follow-up question to that would be, how did you go from being a multifamily value-add guy to literally being a developer? Because again, we were touching on how sophisticated the development world is.
Yes, great point. I mean, going into development is definitely just a whole other ball game within commercial real estate. It's not something you can just, unless like depending on your risk profile and how much money you have to spend and all the risk you can take with that. But if you want to get into development right and not make mistakes and be conservative, the way I did it was get into my first project with a mentor of mine. So this is a friend I've known for a long time, a good partner now as well. And a mentor is kind of how I broke into my first multifamily development deal. And that's that first one you mentioned. That's the $33 million project in Fishers, Indiana, which is just about 10 minutes northeast of Indianapolis. So this is a public-private partnership with the city of Fishers, 84 units and about 20,000 square feet of office and commercial. And this was like my first sort of breaking into the development space, is partnering with somebody that's already been in the space for about 20 years.
Great. Yeah. I mean, a lot of times people, you know, even myself, I used to be a home builder for 10 years. I knew everything about construction and what have you, but I didn't understand development, right? I used to see, and my mom used to talk about Trump all the time. I'm somewhat of a Trump supporter, but I mean, I got to be careful saying that these days, even though he's a president of the United States and is about to go to war any day now. He's probably going to hit Iran before the weekend here or sometime this week. But I used to see Trump's name on these buildings, and people right away assumed that he's actually building the buildings. He's there, maybe swinging hammer himself, and he's building these buildings. But that wasn't the case. Trump, you know, he did build the Trump Tower in New York. That was a project he did with his father in the 80s, I believe. But any other project he did, subsequent project he's done, he hasn't been a developer. He hasn't been a general contractor. He hasn't been the investor. He's just lent his name and brand to the developer to build that project. So that was his business strategy, people to use Trump Tower the same way they use Ritz-Carlton or other big brands or Shangri-La, other big brands that are used. They use their brand to, the developer uses their brand to build these structures and so on. So, but taking that out of the equation, talking about strictly about a developer, what is a developer? Because people, even people who are experienced like myself, they have this misconception that a developer is the general contractor, is the person who goes and actually hires the trades, hires the suppliers, oversees the project timeline, deals with the city. But a developer is not really that. A developer is really the mastermind behind the project who somewhat oversees and but brings in all of these professionals. Maybe touch on that a bit if you like, if I'm going down the right path here, Justin, if you like.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. It's a very key point that some people miss. But yeah, to your point, a developer, I think of them as being sort of like at the top of the pyramid, if you can picture that. And a developer is leveraging their knowledge and expertise in the space. Like the developer has like the vision of the entire project. And then they're going out and hiring all these different third-party companies to help them build the project. So like for us, like we are not vertically integrated at the moment. So we go out and we hire an architect, a civil engineer, the construction company, and we hire all these different companies to help us build the project instead of doing this all ourselves. Because, you know, you could ask me questions about the actual, framing in the building or civil engineering questions and, you know, this or that. Like, I don't know all these different aspects of civil engineering or architecture or environmental. So I go out and hire these experts to work with me on the project. So I think of the developer as like just having the vision, and they're putting the project together while, you know, leveraging the knowledge and expertise of other third-party companies to work with. So yes, yeah, to answer your question, our company is not building the actual project. We go out and hire a construction management team that goes out there and hires different subcontractors to build it. And then they're managing the process for us, and we're managing them along with reviewing the budget, reviewing costs, doing draw requests with the bank, all the stuff on the back end to make sure the project goes smoothly.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just to kind of be the advocate of some development companies that are not vertically integrated, I would actually say in some cases, it might be a better option, because if you, and we've learned this with CPI here ourselves as well, when you are building the infrastructure internally and you're bringing on team members to do a certain task and duties and responsibilities, you are limited to that group that you've created. Whereas, you know, if, let's say a development company wants to bring in architecture internal, right? So you're just limited to that architect you have in-house. Whereas if you want to go and use an external architect, you can go to all the firms out there and hire the best ones that you please. And that's your only exposure to that firm and that service provider. Same thing for others as well. GC, same thing. A lot of times people bring in GC in-house, but there's a level of liability. I think it's fashionable and it sounds sexy to say you're vertically integrated and do everything in-house. But I think there is literally some advantages to have some of the service providers being external. At some point, it makes sense to do it internally, like a merchant home builder, like a D.R. Horton obviously has the architect in-house. Some of these other groups bring their legal department becomes in-house. But all of this creates a lot of different liabilities, and it makes sense sometimes and doesn't make sense in other cases as well. But a couple of other questions about these service providers I want to touch on is something I was very familiar with. I was somewhat familiar with when I wanted to get into large scale development and transitioning from being a home builder was these concept of feasibility studies. Now, in the projects that you're doing, we talk about multifamily. So you're not doing a build to sell project. So it's not a condo project or what have you. Now, at some point you might sell the project, but it's a for rent product, right? It's, you're chasing that yield that the rents produce. So is there feasibility studies done? Is there just like the contractors you hire, the trades you hire, the service providers you hired? Who does those studies to say, hey, is your idea that the vision that you have, does it even make sense? Is that something you guys look at or have any experience with?
Yeah, really just me. So I am really doing like the whole kind of cost analysis in the beginning, like all the underwriting, seeing if this project makes sense based on the rents, based on the market, the cost. So I'm really kind of doing all those things on the front end to see if the project makes sense. And our last three projects have been very similar in their own ways. I mean, they're unique in their own ways, but very similar. So our last three projects, we've used the same construction company, the same architect, the same civil engineer, and two of those projects actually even like use the same bank. So we're taking like what works on previous projects and using that again and again, and the same team members as well, to kind of save from making mistakes, trying to like reinvent the wheel every time, and just trying to take like what works and bring that into each new project and just be consistent as possible.
And that's the easy way to do it. Yeah, absolutely.
Genius. Because we've learned as well with some of our service providers, now they're our legal teams, our compliance teams, they're literally on our, we have a Slack channel dedicated in communications with them. Like we get so comfortable and makes things so much more smooth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Justin, what's the business strategy for your development project? Is it to stabilize and then sell to an institution, or is it to stabilize, refinance, and then hold long-term?
Yeah, great question. I get this question a lot. I hate saying it depends, but it does depend, as you guys know, on how the market is, how interest rates are, what happens when we're going to, you know, go to lease it up and sell it or hold it. So it does depend. But to answer your question, we are looking to sell. So we're looking to build the project, lease it up, and sell really like as quickly as possible. Reason being for that is because I want to focus on being a developer. And back to your point, August, about, you know, when you're bringing in companies in-house, like construction or property management, I kind of have like that similar mindset around this topic, because once you choose to lease up the property and then hold on to it, well, I mean, now you're an asset manager. So now you have to worry about all the performance and communications with the property management company. So it just like adds like one more thing to your plate. And similar thing, like if you had a in-house construction company, well, now you're not just a developer. You're a construction company owner. Now you have payroll. Now you have more overhead. So for our projects, at least like for the time being, we are looking to just stay like being like laser focused on being a developer. So that's building, leasing up, and selling as quickly as possible. That way, like I can, you know, take the win and move on to the next project. Yeah. So I enjoy being the developer. I enjoy, you know, looking for deals, underwriting deals, the construction process. I don't enjoy asset management. I don't enjoy working with the property management companies and dealing with the tenants and all that overhead each month. So I'm just looking to be a developer and continue doing more and more projects.
Nice. Yeah. Market opportunistic.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, allow me to throw somewhat of a wrench towards your vision here. When I was, again, going back to my stories of being a home builder, I was very inquisitive kind of with these larger developers, and I would go for lunch with them at times and what have you, the guys who build the low rise and high rise, these huge projects. And I was so excited to learn. And some of them actually did invest in value add deals or at least existing assets. And my question was, why bother? Why would you invest in this? Initially, I didn't ask that. This was later on. I was pondering, why would they do that? And that was more about their balance sheet. They wanted to have a level of cash flow associated with their balance sheet to showcase when they went out, got loans, and that cash flow would keep them going in case something came up or there was calamities in their business. A lot of developers get used to just rolling over there because they really drink their own Kool-Aid. So they just roll over their winnings into the next deal. So when a market goes bad, developers get hit harder than anybody else because they're not diversified, because their next deal is the best deal possible. It gives the best returns possible. So diversifying into some not necessarily value add, but some cash flowing deals is better. That's what I've learned, but just wanted to share that.
Nice.
No. Yeah, that makes sense.
Let's get a bit complicated now, and you're the guru of calculations. So when you do a development project for apartments, there's a calculation called yield on cost and another one called untrended yield on cost and another one called unlevered yield on cost. Can you give us a quick description of what these calculations mean? And also, can you discuss, let's do that first before my next question. Can you give us a quick description of what those three mean? And then we'll go to the next question.
Yeah. So the yield on cost, and this is like a really common commercial real estate metric altogether, but all kinds of different companies use this no matter like what asset class they're in. It's also important for the value add space, but yes, extremely important for development. So yield on cost is the way I look at it. It's just like your yield of return after the property is leased up, stabilized, and cash flowing. So yield on cost, the calculation is your yield or against your cost. So what that property is producing in income as far as the NOI divided by your total project cost or your all-in basis on the deal, because that's what you spent on the deal to build it. And you're looking at your return on what that based on that cost. So you take your stabilized yield or your NOI divided by your total project cost. So that shows you what you're making on a return basis after the property is leased up and stabilized.
That's on an annual basis, obviously, right? You're talking about annual.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. Nice. Okay.
Untrended is just cutting out like all the noise of rent growth. So as real estate investors, we project a certain amount of organic rent increases or organic growth year over year. That, you know, just throws in like another variable in your underwriting, more kind of just guesswork, and, you know, it's more aggressive to some extent. So untrended yield on cost is just looking at the same calculation, but it cuts out all the noise of, you know, rent growth. So just looking at your top line collected rents minus your vacancy, minus your operating expenses, and then that stabilized NOI or net operating income with no rent growth associated to it against your total project cost. That is your untrended yield on cost. Unlevered is just looking at returns on an all cash basis, so no debt involved. So there's unlevered and levered returns. Unlevered is just returns on an all cash basis, and levered returns, all the returns we look at after the loan or after the debt comes involved.
Got it. A few questions for you there. When it comes to yield on cost, is it assuming that the property is only held for 1 year, or is it different types of yield on costs? Are you looking at kind of, you're doing an analysis on a project that you're looking to build and stabilize and sell? Are you just looking at the yield on cost that you're going to be making on your first year, or as depends on your business plan? If your business plan is a 3-year business plan, does it look at the average kind of yield over that 3 years or that term of the project, or is just for 1 year?
I look at the yield on cost on like a best case scenario. So I have like my projected rents in my underwriting model, and I calculate the rents, you know, if the property was 100% leased up, here's my top line revenue number. And then I look at that, I add in my vacancy, my other income, and then I subtract out my operating expenses. So I take my like stabilized pro forma, like exactly what it's going to look like on a stabilized basis, and then calculate my NOI that way. Does that make sense?
It does. So when somebody's looking at untrended yield on cost, they're assuming from the data the first shovel hits the ground, or even before that, that they're not factoring in any rent growth for that time period. Not like I was getting confused where I was thinking that untrended yield on cost means that they're saying, hey, we're going to keep this property for 5 years after it's built and stabilized. And over that 5 years, we're not going to put any rent growth. Or is it for that period, or is it in a period while it's going under construction that you're not adding any rent growth? You're assuming the rent growth of today. Which one is untrended yield on cost? This is getting super complicated, but people might be lost. But yeah, maybe you have an answer for that.
I mean, strictly speaking, like on the analysis part, so like looking in your underwriting model, like not like what's happening in real life after the project is built, you can calculate it that way. But like I'm like more looking at it from like an underwriting perspective. So untrended just has like 0% rent growth. So like here are your projected rents, and here's like your top line revenue number if the property was 100% occupied. And then you add in your other income, like trash, utilities, things like that, that you're charging the tenants, take out your vacancy, take out your expenses, and that is your stabilized NOI. Assuming you had those correct expenses, assuming you had those rents in real life, that is your projected yield on cost with no rent growth.
That makes a lot of sense. As you also mentioned, Ava asked you about unlevered yield on cost. Why even have such a metric? Where does this even come up? Why do people even care?
I don't think unlevered yield on cost is too common, at least like in a space that I've seen. There are like unlevered returns. You can look at returns on unlevered basis, the IRR, equity multiple, et cetera. Some operators and some institutional groups like to see returns on an unlevered basis just to kind of cut out the noise of debt and just purely see what the returns are on an operational basis. And we all know, like, once you bring debt into the equation, into the deal, debt always enhances returns. So I'm not as too concerned as for the unlevered returns, because like, yeah, I'm always using debt for properties. And, of course, most real estate investors are. So I'm always looking at returns like on a levered basis or after debt becomes involved.
Got it. That makes sense. Now, Justin, can you also discuss the difference between yield on cost and cap rate?
Yeah, yield on cost is looking at your yield in comparison to the total cost it took to build the deal. And cap rate is just looking at your return on your investment, more associated with like existing multifamily properties. It's just looking at your NOI divided by your purchase price. So your cap rate might be 6%, which could be pretty acceptable in some markets, but the cap rate does not have all your costs included in that deal. So you may have bought the property for X amount of purchase price, but how much did you spend on the property in your all-in basis? So like how much do you spend on CapEx? So the cap rate does not account for your CapEx or improvements you made to the property, while the yield on cost does. It's taking your yield or your rate of return divided against your total all-in basis or your total project cost. And cap rate is just your rate of return on your purchase price.
Incredible. Awesome. Thanks for breaking that down for us. So next topic here, there's a way to underwrite multifamily deal, and we call it the back of the napkin underwriting or analysis. And we will know pretty quick if the broker is out to lunch or not, or if the deal actually makes sense, and if we should even do a deeper dive into the underwriting, right? And that's really by seeing what the asking price is, what the current NOI is, what's the prevailing cap rate in the market, where the rents are at, if there's a value add component perhaps. But is there a back of the napkin, quick underwriting analysis that you can do when you're looking at a development deal, if you should even bother with it or not?
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, back to the yield on cost thing, but I'm usually doing like a very quick kind of back of the envelope analysis for development and looking at that yield on cost and how it looks at the market cap rate. So yeah, to answer your question, I'm usually looking for a spread between my market cap rate and the yield on cost of about 1.5 to 2%. So I want my stabilized yield on cost to be 2% higher than the cap rate. So on my sort of, back of the envelope approach, when I do my rough numbers about rents and cost and my projections, I'm sort of solving for that yield on cost and spread number to see if it's higher than the market cap rate in the area. If it's, low or negative, then I know like something in the analysis has changed, whether that's cost, land, rents, things like that. But that's sort of like how I get a good feel, just for like a quick look on development to see if it's feasible or needs some work.
Nice. Awesome. I remember when Paul advertised to give out his back of the napkin analysis at an event that he spoke at. So many people signed up for that. So it's very helpful. Now let's go back to talking about your $33 million development project. I get really excited to talk about syndicating because I absolutely love, you know, raising money from investors, you know, having the relationships. And when the team does, when a deal does pencil out and they say, you know, they say, okay, let's under contract and go ahead with it. They really come to me and say, okay, Ava, let's raise $10.5 million of equity or let's raise $4 million of equity. And I absolutely love this part of the business. So my question for you is...
Yeah, you got to see Ava's cell phone, but the phone number that says accredited investors after the first name, last name. If she scrolls, it doesn't stop. People have her.
I've talked to about 1,000 investors, accredited investors over the last 5 years or so. So yeah, I really enjoy that part of the business. But on your development project, did you syndicate that deal, Justin?
Correct. We are syndicating all of our development projects. Correct.
Oh, right on. Okay. Awesome. Do you want to get into syndication a little bit, August, or do you want to just focus on the development?
I think we have some questions coming up about syndication at some point.
We do. So let's go into the next question. So that's good to know.
Okay. Perfect. So when it comes to the profile, right, this is about the profile of the investors who get involved. Now, at CPI, we're doing both development for sale product. And similar to yours, more on the BTR side and then a multifamily value add as well. But the investor appetite and profile seems to change a bit. Obviously, investors who trust us and have done deals with us over the years and they've known us, they see us as their fiduciary. So they jump in on most deals that we have in front of them. But some investors who are somewhat newer, they're either a development type investor or a value add investor. And that's really because the yield that value-add deals produce. In most cases, value-add deals are cash flowing day one in most cases. These days might be a little bit harder, but historically they have. So, and that gets advertised to investors that, hey, you're going to be making 5% cash flow over the, you know, average cash flow over the term of this project, this five-year term. So they know, hey, they have some cash flow coming. And psychologically, when you have some money coming in on an investment you made, at least you have, you know, can sleep at night better knowing, you know, at least there's some money coming in. Development is not the case, right? Development is a situation where you're going all in. Obviously, there's the property, there's no existing structure there. So it's not producing any income. You're waiting for all the upside on the back end. But overall, what type of economics are your investors, your LP? What is your LP economics you're trying to achieve on these development projects?
Yeah, great question. For our investors, yeah, you're correct. It is sort of like a different appetite for development and different risk profile when you go into development. We work with investors that are not so much concerned or wanting to see like a 5 or 6 coupon year over year. These are investors that are more just like having like that longer term mindset, and they understand the business plan and they're wanting more like an equity multiple at the end of the day. So they're not so much as concerned as earning that cash flow. They want to see like that big pop at the end. They want to multiply their equity as fast as possible. And like I mentioned, like we're not looking to hold on to our properties for, you know, 4 or 5, you know, 6 years plus. We're looking to build, lease up, and sell as fast as possible. And so that can help out the IRR when it's a faster sell. And yeah, we're just looking to multiply our investors' capital as quick as possible at the end of the day.
Nice. Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised actually, because we were doing multifamily value add properties and obviously our investors were investing. When we presented our first development deal, the investor appetite was quite high. I mean, we did build the trust with the investors, but they're like, hey, you know what? I would love to do a shorter term, 2 years.
Because the returns are higher, right?
I'd love to have higher returns.
Optically.
Not to have cash flow for a couple of years. And so, yeah, it was pleasantly surprising to see the investor appetite. So I guess for you, yeah, you probably had a lot of multifamily investors that were on your multifamily value add side that joined you when you launched your development deal. As well, I'm sure.
Correct. Yeah, they had to have, you know, plenty of investors that switched over and trusted the process on development. And there is one key distinction. So we do start distributing cash when it's available. So it's not just like the sell at the end of the hold period, but we do start distributing cash once the property is, you know, leased up and stabilized. So there it is, just like a normal syndication structure, just like that. Another key point is that investors are accruing that preferred return from day one.
Yeah.
So they're not earning that cash flow, you know, from the day of closing, but they are earning that or accruing that preferred return day one from closing as well. So that kind of helps out, you know, aligning incentives with investors too.
Oh, the whole preferred return gets accrued on an annual basis?
Correct. The day of closing, they are accruing that preferred return.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Nice.
Okay.
Right on. Okay, Justin, this is a great question that I'm looking forward to getting your feedback on, but how is your time allocated managing a development firm? that does all of this sophisticated stuff, like we were talking about, right? And then also worrying about equity and debt. So how do you manage everything? Like, how do you allocate your time between all these sophisticated things that need to get done in a day?
Great question. I would say the majority of my time is keeping my pipeline full, because in development, it could take, you know, I could find a deal for a potential project tomorrow, and it could take a year before I even start that project. So my biggest things I try to focus on is finding the next opportunity. So like on that first project that we did, the $33 million project, I had my next one breaking ground about 6 months before that one. The first one was leasing up. Now on my second one, it's about 50% of the way through construction, and I have my next one breaking ground this year. So, nice. I'm trying to keep my pipeline full, because in development, I similar with you guys, but you never know like when your next deal is going to be or your next opportunity. So you always have to be continuing to look for new projects and look for the next opportunity. And that's the biggest thing that's going to move the needle in my business. So I spend most of my time looking for new projects. The other bulk of my time is definitely on my current projects. So managing the draw process, sending out wires to the contractors and vendors that we work with on a monthly basis. That definitely takes a lot of time on its own. It's kind of like a whole other job within development. And also visiting the sites. I visit all my sites that are under construction on a weekly basis, and managing the contractors, reviewing the budgets, and just making sure things are, you know, staying on track and on time.
That's awesome. And I guess on the equity side of the business, when doing development, you can raise in tranches as well, right? You don't have to raise all the capital right at the front. So it's not this big push to get all your capital up front, or is that, how do you approach it?
That is a very positive aspect about development, because like, you know, I could be working on a project for an entire year. So I have time to sort of notify my investors, answer questions, you know, give them plenty of notice before we actually need the funds. Yeah. So it is a lot of the, you know, leeway in that timeline. But once we're, you know, between 3 and 4 months from breaking ground, then we are really, really pushing our investors to join us on the investment and, help us fund the equity portion for it.
The rest of the equity, after.
Correct. And a key point that, not all developers do this, but throughout that, you know, whatever it is, 8 months, a year that I'm spending on the project to actually get it to the, you know, through the approval process and rezoning and working with the bank, and, you know, city fees and all this stuff, I am putting like all my capital up front at risk and not raising capital from investors during that portion of time.
Nice.
So we are only getting investors involved like once the property is fully rezoned, fully approved, and we are basically like ready to start construction and close on the bank loan. That is only when we are getting investors involved, and we have a lot of capital up front at risk for that entire year and all the things we have to do to get that project shovel ready.
And for the land acquisition, right? As well.
Correct. Exactly.
Okay. Yes.
Or sometimes you can be creative and put a contract with the seller of the land that you don't complete until the
permits have been completing and absolutely.
Correct. Yeah. We usually try and give our, on the terms of our contract, we usually try and give ourselves plenty of time.
Yeah.
But there's been times where like we've had to buy the land before we actually had everything approved. We had a lot of confidence everything was going to go through. But we usually try to give ourselves plenty of time with the contract, so we have to buy land first or, you know, do things like that before we're fully approved.
Okay, right on. Well, awesome. Okay, that's good to know. Justin, what kind of softwares does your team use for project management? And what software do you use for budgeting? And obviously to make sure there's no cost overruns. Like, there's so much to keep track on. And obviously we know that, you know, prices change pretty quickly. So let's talk about the softwares you use.
On the like investment or investor management side, like we're using Cashflow Portal.
Okay.
Really love Cashflow Portal for all of our investor software and sending out updates and distributions, things like that. I also use that for my CRM, and really just, AI for a lot of things as well nowadays, like always using AI and ChatGPT to do a number of things in my business.
On the project management side, because obviously you oversee, even though the GC is pretty autonomous building the project, you have to kind of oversee making sure they're hitting the milestones on the project timeline and hitting the milestones when it comes to budgeting. Is there a software you use internally, or is it more just have Excel that supports you there, like, or my project? Is there any?
Like, for example, on a single family home that we did together, August and I, we use Builder Trend. That was
That's more for single family. A lot of builders use that because their clients can log in and see what stage the project is at. doesn't work the best for larger development projects. But these larger firms, that do have large development projects, they have an asset management team internally that's mm-hmm. overseeing the GC, in most cases being external, and they have their own type of softwares. You know, our partner, Paul, used to build bridges, and on these large bridge projects, they have like dedicated people that are on the project management side, and they're using their own softwares, kind of looking at the different parts of the bridge development projects that you look at, what softwares they use. Is there particular softwares you guys, or you keep it pretty high level kind of Excel, since the GC is doing all the actual management, day-to-day management of the progress?
Our construction company uses a software called ProjectSight. And then we basically just have an account with ProjectSight, and we're able to go in there and review budgets, check on timelines, look at pictures every single day. But yeah, ProjectSight is the software we use for development.
Nice. Nice. I guess it does both. It does budget and timelines. Amazing.
Right on.
Great.
Okay.
One quick question before getting to the point here. You talked about Indianapolis. You're physically there. Your project is there. Were you originally always from Indiana, or?
Yes.
So the reason you're there, because you understand the market well, you're from there, your team is there. Any plans to expand, or you feel pretty comfortable? Because I mean, every time I listen to experts talking about markets, Indiana always comes up as this sleeping giant, the slow and steady is done really well, because it doesn't have the boom and bust cycles that these growth markets like the DFWs and Austin's and Phoenix and other markets have. So, or Las Vegas and what have you, is what's the kind of market expansion that you're looking at? Is it to stay there or grow from there?
Yes, I love Indiana, born and raised here my whole life. Yeah, my way of looking at that is like, I already live in just a fantastic market for, I mean, not only living in, but investing in real estate as well. So I don't have a lot of motivation to look elsewhere. I'm already in a fantastic market with a really strong fundamentals to already start investing in real estate. Not to say like, you know, at a certain scale or, you know, down the road, 5, 10 years, whatever it may be, I might look in other markets or other states as well. But for the time being, like, there's just so much opportunity here in Indiana. And like you said, like, we don't have like the boom or bust. It's very consistent, very steady for like the last couple of years, while, you know, many of the nation's largest cities were flat or even negative rent growth in some cases. Indiana was still very steady at around 2-3%, while, you know, many cities were flat or negative. So it's very, you know, very consistent. Doesn't have like a lot of different fluctuations in the market. And at the same point, like, I just like being within a few hours driving distance of my projects because, mm-hmm. you know, when you're, I mean, our construction company is great. I mean, they're fantastic, but this is not a business plan where you can just hire the GC and say, okay, just go build a project and let me know when it's done. Like, you have to actively be walking around that site, reviewing your plans, spotting things that are incorrect, because nobody else is going to catch that besides you, the developer, or, you know, maybe your architect, maybe somebody else. But there's been plenty of times where I've actually walked the site and found things that are incorrect, you know, mid-construction. So you have to be hands-on. You have to be on the site actively managing these projects. It's not something you can just hire and say, you know, just let me know when it's finished. I'm sure everything will go well. It's absolutely not like that. So it's a lot easier for me to go do that and travel to these projects when they're under construction, if it's an hour or a couple of hours driving distance, versus, you know, getting on a plane and going across the country every time I got to tour a project under construction.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Since you are in this foundational part of your journey when it comes to development, is very important part as well. As you're bringing on the right team members, you partner with somebody who's more experienced and you're kind of building that for yourself. But when you're building your internal team members, right, who is the first person you want to bring on? Is that somebody that has a GC type of guy who's going to oversee the external GC that you're going to be hiring? Is it a project management type of guy who understands project management? Is it a CPA who helps like be a chief operating officer? Is it an investor relations guy? Who do you feel, and I'm sure you've thought about this a lot, but as you grow, who's that, or maybe you already have this person, but who do you feel is that first integral, important person that's coming in, that pivotal person that's coming in? Who's that?
Yeah, great question. The first team member that I plan to bring on is a construction manager. So somebody that can do just what I mentioned, but walking all of our sites on a weekly basis, and somebody who's familiar with construction, who can spot things that are incorrect, who can go out there and catch things proactively when they're wrong per the plans. So, you know, at the time, or you know, when the time comes that I have multiple projects that are under construction at once, it's going to be really difficult for, you know, one person to, you know, drive to and walk all these different sites every single week. So bringing on a construction manager and somebody that can do that for me and who's familiar with construction, I think would be a valuable asset to the team.
A couple of more quick questions before we get to the next segment of the show. What's the long-term vision for Gooden Development? Is it right now kind of exciting space you're in, middle market, multifamily development in that market? Is that where you want to be for foreseeable future?
Definitely for the foreseeable future, yes. I mean, just staying laser focused on what we're doing now. I mean, just building the same kind of product, which is, you know, class A, market rate and mixed use here in Indiana. Don't have any plans on, you know, building like affordable properties or student housing or lower tier type assets. Really just kind of focused on that luxury, A-class and market rate type kind of property.
Nice. Last question before the next set of questions is, and we can talk about this. It doesn't have to be depend on our guests and their expertise. We kind of switch this question around, but let's talk about the commercial real estate market, which encompasses, multifamily development or multifamily value add, basically like that space. If the market cycle was a clock and the top of the market was 12 o'clock and the bottom of the market was 6 o'clock, top of the market being mania, there's non-refundable deposits, people are just going absolutely berserk over deals. Deals are being traded, like 80s, 90s deals are being traded at sub four caps. The market is in mania. 6 o'clock is either in recession, people are walking away from their deposits. You know, the market is definitely in that recession phase. If you had to guess, what time is it today?
I'd say 8 o'clock. I'd say like we're, you know, coming out of some, you know, turbulent and bad times, but I don't think we're all the way out of those times yet. I'm also still kind of nervous on how like AI is going to come into play in the next couple of years, like how that's going to do, what's it going to do for the unemployment rate, the job growth and tariffs, or, you know, some things on my mind as well. So I think I'm very optimistic. I'll say that, very optimistic, especially in multifamily. But yeah, I think we're sort of coming out of the lower end of this cycle, but not sort of like in this like expansionary period just yet.
Got it. So pretty close to 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock. All right. Great.
All right, Justin. Perfect. That was.
Thank you so much for answering our question.
Yeah, thank you so much for the
question. But now we're going to get some more questions coming at you.
On the more personal side. So next segment of our show is called the 10 Championship Rounds to Financial Freedom. I'm going to ask you 10 questions and whatever comes top of mind, are you ready?
Ready.
Okay, let's get into it. First question, who's been the most influential person in your life?
My parents.
Nice.
You want an explanation or just like a quick?
Yeah, explanation would be wonderful. Absolutely. Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Yeah, parents have always been very supportive of me, my business, my goals, like what I've done in life. They've always been there for advice and suggestions, but they've always been supportive in everything I do.
That's so sweet. Atlas and Apollo, our 1 and 2 year old, hopefully they will be saying the same thing. I always love to hear that. That's wonderful, Justin. Next question is, what is the number one book you would recommend?
Probably like Stay Sane and Unsane World, written by Greg Hardin. He was sort of like the mindset coach for Tom Brady and other athletes out there, but it's more like a mindset book. So really recommend that book.
Nice. Okay. Let's add that. August and I read for an hour a night together. Love that. Thank you for sharing. Next question is, if you had the opportunity to travel back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
To start a business. I would go back in time to, you know, like my teenage years and just tell myself to start a business. Not that there's anything wrong with, working a W-2 or a career and climbing that corporate ladder. But I think like the more you're willing to take, risk, calculated risk is where you're going to get like those outside returns or oversized returns in your life. Mm-hmm. So I think if you just go like that traditional normal path, you're going to have a very traditional and normal life. I'm not saying you can't have a great life with the W-2 and having a career, but starting a business can teach you so many different things and really kind of be like that fast track to financial freedom for you.
Love that. Awesome. All right, Justin, next question. What's the best investment you've ever made?
Best investment ever made was a 6-unit property that I bought from a 30-year owner. This happened about 3 years ago.
Nice.
Found it from a cold email that I sent, bought it for super cheap, raised the value of it by doing a, you know, classic value add strategy and sold it for about 18 months later, made like $189,000 profit, something like that in like 18 months. So that was like the best investment I've made so far.
Nice.
Our developer guest's best investment is a value item.
Yeah. Nice. Now, Justin, what's the worst investment you ever made and what lessons did you learn from it?
I haven't had any investments that have really gone wrong or gone that bad. I guess like the worst one that comes to mind is just was buying a single family house on the west side of Indianapolis. This was a house that I really didn't know anything about real estate, but I wanted to get into real estate. And the first thing that, you know, many people think of when they want to get into real estate is like, I'll go fix and flip a house or I'll go buy a rental. And so yeah. I bought a rental and I bought this shortly before COVID happened. And it was pretty good investment before that. But then when COVID happened and they had all the eviction restrictions and you couldn't raise rents or evict everybody, this person stayed in the house for about a year and didn't pay rent on purpose to abuse the system. And wow. So I had to continue paying the mortgage by myself. And he messed up the house when he left. And then I had to spend more money to fix up the house and ultimately ended up selling it, but it wasn't like a big home run in the end.
Oh, man. Sorry you had to go through that.
Sorry.
All right. Next question, Justin. How much would you need in the bank to retire today? What's your number?
Probably at least, that's good. That's an interesting question. I mean, at least $5 million to retire.
Nice. It's a good number.
Using that to like reinvest into cash flowing assets and make more money like along the way. But I guess like retire and do nothing like at least $5 million.
Nice. Right on. All right. Next question. If you had dinner with someone dead or alive, who would it be?
I would probably say Elon Musk, just to kind of hear his thoughts and thinking on different, you know, topics. But he seems like a really interesting guy to, you know, talk with.
Oh, that's a good one.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Why not have lunch or dinner with the richest man in the world?
Yeah, no big deal. All right, Justin, if you weren't doing what you're doing today, what would you be doing now?
I would probably be, if I wasn't a developer.
Yeah.
It's more about like, I think we got to kind of redo this question, but it's more about kind of, if you were younger, was there anything in sports you ever wanted to become? Was there anything in arts, music, rock star? Was there like... anything or any hobbies you have on the side, motorcycle riding? We had a guest who talked about being a hunter and there would be a professional hunter. Like anything there, if it wasn't in the business and space you're in now, is anything you wanted to pursue at some point in your life that it just didn't work out?
No, I've been doing real estate for pretty much like ever since I went down like that entrepreneurship journey. Mm-hmm. I guess like if I wasn't in real estate, I'd imagine I would have probably been like working a W-2 or a career for a period of time and then starting some other form of a business, whether that's like a service-based business, a contracting business. I'd imagine I would have like my own business somehow.
A true entrepreneur.
Very structured. Yes. Very structured.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Justin, my favorite question, book smarts or street smarts?
Book smarts.
No.
Two for two today.
Yeah. Huh.
All right.
Yeah. I've always just been like more the kind of person that does well in school, that it, you know, enjoys reading books and be like just more like on the educational part. But yeah, I definitely think that I'm more book smart than street smart.
Okay. Right on. Awesome. Last question, Justin. If you had $1 million in cash and you had to make one investment today, what would it be?
I would buy some sort of either like existing property to hold on to long term, whether that's a commercial real estate asset as far as multifamily or some sort of like cash flowing real estate asset, or nice. I would buy a business.
Nice. Okay. I love it. Real estate investors aren't going to like me very much, but if I had $1 million cash today, I would buy Bitcoin at $67,000.
Long. Right. No, I wouldn't do that.
I know. I'm like, people aren't going to like this very much. Justin, just let everybody know what the best way that they can reach you, please.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. You can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook just by typing my name, Justin Gooden. You can also go to goodendevelopment.com on the front page there. I have a free 7-day passive real estate investing 101 course. Kind of shows you the in and outs of passively investing in syndication the right way. So that's at goodindevelopment.com and you can find it on the first page.
Nice. And we'll put that in the show notes as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks, Justin. It's been so nice getting to know you better. Putting a face to face. How awesome
yeah,
is that?
It took a few years, but we got him on.
That's awesome.
Thank you for coming on.
Thanks, Justin.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us for this episode. We hope this conversation enlightened you on how to win big in this highly profitable and risk-averse space. Get on your feet and embrace this world that offers so many opportunities just waiting for you out there.
Continue your journey to becoming a savvy real estate expert by subscribing to the show at cpicapital.ca. Don't forget to leave a positive rating and share with your friends. See you on the next one.